And welcome into Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're on the Game Nashville app. You just heard where you can watch as well on Twitter, Twitch, Facebook, all of those things. And pleased to be joined with you tonight. Chase McCabe here with you. Hope you're having a great Wednesday. The Predators coming off a tough one last night against a very good team, the Toronto Maple Leafs, dropping that one 3-0. They were supposed to play tomorrow night against the Ottawa Senators, but that game has been postponed, and so they're back at it. Saturday night, hockey night in Canada against Montreal and the Canadiens. So we will have a lot to discuss with that as we move on. But I am so excited about our guest lineup tonight. We're going to be joined by Olympic gold medalist Scott Hamilton in the second half of the show. But coming up right now, this guy still leads the franchise in goals with 210, assists with 356, points with 566, games played 956, and game-winning goals at 41. We say hello to the first ever draft pick of the Nashville Predators, David Legwan. David, how you doing?
Good. How are you guys?
I'm doing fantastic. It's been a while. Good to talk to you. What have you been up to? I know you have kind of transitioned into an ownership role since your playing career ended. So how's that going?
It's good. It's exciting. It keeps you involved. My 12-year-old son is also playing. They're in their Quebec Pee-wee year, so doing those types of things, it's fun, and staying involved with Sarnia and those things is also very exciting for myself.
Yeah, I can imagine. And what's it like being dad and watching your son play now?
It's interesting. It's a lot different than when I was a kid. I think the coaches have got to be a little nicer than they were back 30 years ago. So it's fun, though, to see all the kids grow up and watch them get better just with their team from when they started in late August till now, and see the stride that they've taken and those types of things is exciting.
When you're working with him and teaching him things, how much do you take away from, you know, experiences you had? Do you watch old film of games of yourself to show him stuff, or are you kind of letting him experience things on his own and trying not to be the former NHL player that's coaching his son, or do you kind of do a little bit of both?
No, they got to figure it out themselves. It's every kid's different, and you got to figure out what you're good at and what you can get better at and those types of things. And it'll come for all of them. And you know, some of them grow at different times. They hit spurts at different times and those types of things. So it's an ongoing process with all of them, I think. And it's fun to see them all.
So as I mentioned, obviously 1998, the Predators become a franchise in the NHL. You were the second overall pick in that draft, the first ever draft pick by this organization, and you made your debut in the last game of that year. But when you got drafted, you get the call from David Poile and you come to Nashville for the first time. Obviously Nashville in 1998 and Nashville now are two very different cities, but what was your first impression of Nashville the first time that you came here?
I'm excited. I think obviously it's like you just said, from 98 to now, it's completely changed. You know, 98, me coming from Detroit down to Nashville was different for me. It was exciting. It was new. It was, you know, hockey was new down there. And the fan base was super excited to have us. And that's proven itself over the course of time. I know there was a couple hiccups there along the way, but obviously the fans have come through in a strong way. The people of Nashville and have supported the Preds forever. And myself and the guys that were around the early years and the middle years, and now the guys that are playing now, it's taken such a burden on the city, and it's exciting to see and how it's grown and those types of things down there.
Can you recall, like, when you get your career going, and like you said, the fan base starts building, they're coming to the games, people are recognizing the Predators, and you're just walking around Nashville, and maybe the first time you got recognized that somebody goes, "Hey, that's David Legwan. He's one of the Nashville Predators." Do you remember that at all?
A little bit. I was walking. I stayed at the Renaissance there before my first game, and I was walking over to the rink by myself, and someone noticed me and those types of things. So it was kind of, that was kind of neat and interesting. You know, he's an 18-year-old kid. You're not really used to that. I mean, to be noticed on the street, walking to a game, and kind of something you did since you were a kid and those types of things. So it was exciting. But obviously Nashville, the first couple of years, it's country music. It was football. You know, the Titans were on their runs to the Super Bowl and those types of things. So it was a great time to be down there, and it was a great time to have the franchise get off to a decent start. Obviously, the first couple of years, we weren't what everyone wanted. We weren't the Vegas Golden Knights, and you know, but Barry instilled in us that we were going to have an identity, and we were going to work hard every night, and we weren't going to give anyone an easy 2 points. And you know, I think that's been instilled in National Predator hockey for, you know, the full course of their existence.
What was kind of the impressions of, and obviously you're a young guy, you're a rookie, but Barry Trotz has no NHL coaching experience. David Poile, who of course had been a general manager in the National Hockey League for a while, gives him the opportunity, hires Barry Trotz. And it was kind of like you all grew up together. He's experiencing the NHL as a coach for the first time. He's trying to build this roster. David's trying to get the right players in place. But what was kind of the early impressions in your early relationship with Barry Trotz?
Oh, I think it was great. You know, David's a phenomenal human, and that's first and foremost, I think. And that's the same as Barry. He's a better human than a hockey coach, and you know, his story's still being written, and he could go down as, you know, arguably one of the best coaches ever to coach. It's looking that way. You know, he's going to be in the top two or three all time in wins and games coached and everything else. And you know, for Tad and for my 15 years there, and it's kind of unique. I got to play for one coach for 15 years in one city. So you know, that's David. Not, you know, David was very patient and waited, and you know, obviously it's not 2020 where coaches get fired after 1 year and things like that. You know, the first couple of years in Nashville, we had our struggles, and you know, we had losing streaks and those types of things. But you know, I think it made everyone around the organization and the team stronger for sticking together and battling through those things together.
So, David, in working on the broadcast side of things, I've had the opportunity to work with Brent Peterson for the last several years, and the stories that we get out of Brent are fantastic. And I know that, you know, he coached you for a long time, and you guys had a good relationship. What's something you remember about Petey?
Just everything. Petey, you know, another person that's a better human than a hockey person. You know, he had the unfortunate thing of with the Parkinson's, and it didn't faze him at all. It didn't change him at all. He came to the rink with a smile. You would have never known that what he was going through. He kept it away from us, you know, until you know, he obviously can't keep that away from people forever. It's something that they're going to see, they're going to recognize, and those types of things. But for him to do what he did for everybody is pretty powerful. You know, he still does the golf tournaments down there and all those things. And he's been a staple of the community, the team, and those types of things for so many years. And you know, we still talk here and there. He's still in Portland in the Western League. So when I was going through all my stuff with the junior team, I bounced ideas off of him and those types of things. So he's been a phenomenal person. And you know, it was awesome having him as a coach for a lot of those years, and you know, him and Barry had a great relationship, and you couldn't really ask for anything more than that.
Before we step away for a second, early in your career, as you mentioned, you know, David putting this roster together, it was a lot of veteran guys from other teams, because that's how the expansion draft worked. Who was somebody that you leaned on early that kind of helped you get your NHL career going?
Well, we had in my first year there, I was the only guy under 22 or 23 years old. So I kind of leaned on the older guys a little bit, and Bob Bugner was one, and you know, Cliff Ronning and Tommy Fitzgerald, and you know, it's guys that you still see around the rinks nowadays too. It's exciting to see those guys to share a lot of the old stories with, and those teams that were young and kind of, you know, a little bit of what you see nowadays, not as much, but misfits around the league, and you know, the guys that were in the expansion drafts and those types of things that teams might not have wanted or not wanted to deal with anymore. So, you know, another guy, Scotty Walker, is another guy that comes to mind with that group, and you know, he's an owner in the OHL too now. So it's kind of fun to see these guys around and still talk to them quite a bit and share stories with. But we were a pretty close-knit group those first couple of years, and probably Tommy Fitzgerald was the one that kept the whole thing together and had a good beat on the locker room and all that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. He is David Legwan, the first ever draft pick of the Nashville Predators. We're going to step away for just a second. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit about breaking through and into the playoffs and how Leggy had a big part in that as you listen to Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Legwan skating in. McLean out to meet him. Legwan deking. The back end, he scores! And the Predators win in overtime on a penalty shot by David Legwan.
Yes, memories. Back here on Smashville Live, ESPN 102.5 The Game, Chase McCabe and former Predator David Legwan here with you. David, you remember that one?
Yeah, that's a long time ago. That was before Christmas, though, in 2000. It was in Madison Square Garden, so it's obviously a neat memory.
Yeah, you had quite a few of those, but the overtime shootout has to be one that was the overtime penalty shot has to be one that rings up there for you in your career for sure.
Yeah, it is. I didn't even know it until I got off the ice, and I didn't know it was the first one ever in the history of the NHL. So it was pretty neat to find that out right after the game, and it set us off on a little Christmas break. So it was nice.
So as you guys get established and it starts getting close, like the roster, you have draft picks like yourself that are earning their way in. Martin Erad is becoming a staple. Different guys. It's looking like this team is now going from expansion team to a team that can potentially contend and then make the playoffs. And you finally do that in 2004. Now, what was it like for you personally? Because you're going up against the Detroit Red Wings. You're a Detroit guy. And that's a team that, you know, I know I've heard David Poile and others say that you want to model yourselves after just because they've had so much success. But what was it like going up against them being from Detroit?
Well, it was a lot. I think it was, you know, that was pretty salary cap. I think that $81 or $82 million payroll. I think we were right around 18 or 19. So the odds were obviously stacked against us. But I think it was earlier in that year when we were in Detroit. Actually, we were losing 4-1, and with 4 minutes left in the game, and we came back and somehow won the game 5-4 in regulation. It kind of turned our whole season around. And you know, the belief factor was kind of there then, and we kind of knew what our goal was at the end of the year, where we wanted to get to. And you know, obviously you go through the whole year, play Detroit in the first round, and, you know, you go into Detroit, you lose the first two games, and you come back to Nashville for game three, and I don't know if I've ever heard or will ever hear a building as loud in my life again as it was in Nashville for that game three of the first playoff game. It was pretty pretty unique and exciting, and we won games three and four and went back to Detroit for game five. So we ended up losing in six, but I think it was a good learning experience, and that's like the quote of all quotes, right? You got to learn to lose before you can learn to win, and those types of things. So we took some lumps there. And then obviously with the lockout in 2004-05, it kind of reset everything a little bit.
So you bring up that first home playoff game, game three in 2004. I think it's interesting you said that's the loudest you've heard it. Because, I mean, we've heard some loud crowds at Bridgestone Arena, but I can only imagine what that was like the first time experiencing that. But there was a moment in that game that we're going to play that involves you. Let's see if you remember this.
Whitney got it back. Eisenman was waiting, but the puck fed out by Eaton.
Good recovery by Mark Eaton.
And here comes Legwood. The Trevor scores. David Legwood, shorthanded. The Punishers take a 1-0 lead. 18-23 into the period on a turnover by Detroit.
So a turnover by Detroit. You steal the puck shorthanded. Score, put the Predators up 1-0. You go on to win that game. Do you remember who you stole the puck from?
Yeah. It's funny. It gets brought up every once in a while, but I don't like to bring it up to him too much because Patch is a little bit bigger than me. So we harass each other a little bit about it. So it's not brought up too much.
That was my next question, if it ever comes up. Yeah. But pretty funny because now you know, own the Sarnia Sting with Darian Hatcher, who you stole the puck from. But so when you say that it was louder, you think that it was louder in that moment before that game than it was in 2011 when you guys beat the Anaheim Ducks to advance to the second round for the first time?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it was loud. It was loud then too, just because, you know, at that point we had, you know, I don't know if it was the curse of San Jose in 05 and 06 and 06, 07, and then, you know, 08, we lost to the Red Wings again. And, you know, 09, we got banged up with injuries and all those things. And then 10, you know, you lose the game 5 in Chicago in the first round. And, you know, when you kind of have them with their backs up against the wall and they go on to win the Stanley Cup. And then 11, we finally break through and beat Anaheim and, you know, went to a tough series with Vancouver and, you know, and then in 12 beating Detroit and then, you know, losing to Arizona in the second round in 12. So, yeah, it was loud there in 04. That was the loud building. It was unique because it's the first time that anyone's ever seen Stanley Cup hockey down in Nashville. And I think everyone was pretty excited.
So a few years after that, 06, 07, I still think that, you know, top to bottom, that roster that David Poile built is probably the best one this team has ever had. Unfortunately, he had injuries to a lot of key players that kind of stifled things. But did you ever have a moment in time where you thought, you know, hey, I'm going to be playing hockey with Peter Forsberg and Paul Kariya?
No, I didn't. It was actually when we were in Chicago. I forget where we were. We were out to dinner and David called someone, I think he called Jason Arnott, and said, we're trading for Peter Forsberg. And I said, there's no way that we're trading for Peter Forsberg. And then, you know, he gets to the rink the next day, and Peter's the most humble person in hockey, maybe. And, you know, he just comes to the rink, goes about his business, and you know, he's an awesome human. And it was phenomenal to get, you know, we only got to play with him for a month and a half or 2 months, whatever it was, but you know, you got to be like a sponge when you're around him and soak it all up. And, you know, he's one of the greatest ever to play in my mind, and you know, and having Paul Kariya there for a couple of years, and who's another guy I still talk to and keep in touch with, and you know, he's another person that got to grow up there and be part of it. And you're right, those 2 years, 05, 06, 06, 07, those were some hockey teams David built that. I don't know if it was the matchup in the first round with San Jose. I don't know what it was, but those are teams that there are some special talent on those teams.
What did it mean when you find out that Paul Kariya is going to sign as a free agent? Because we always, when we're talking about the history of the Predators, look at that moment as, hey, that's when things really changed. That's when this franchise, like you're getting a guy that is going to be a future Hall of Famer to join what's already here. He wanted to be in Nashville. And he signs as a free agent. What was kind of the thought in the locker room when that news got out?
A little bit. It was summertime. It was a little disbelief. I don't think anyone really believed it at first. And then, you know, you start calling other guys on the team, and they're like, is it really happening? And we were like, yeah, it is. And, you know, we get excited. And Paul actually ended up living out in Franklin by myself. And we would go to lunch before every game together. So really got to know him pretty well and pretty close. So he's an awesome guy. And, you know, it was phenomenal to see someone that prepared for the games like that. And yeah, when it was on his way to the Hall of Fame, and you know, we got to be a part of it and play with him.
So before we let you go, David, on February 24th, the franchise is going to do something it's never done before, and it's going to retire a number. 35 for Pecorino. You played with Pekka for a long time. You saw him at the beginning. Was there a moment that, you know, not necessarily you think, hey, this guy's going to have his number retired one day, but you thought, yeah, he's special. He's going to do things that have never been done in this organization. Was there anything that stood out?
A lot. He's a goalie, and we all know they got weird personalities. He's one of the most normal goalies I think I've ever met. But he's a fun, laughable, lovable guy, and that's first and foremost with me. He's an unbelievable goalie, world class. But yeah, I'm sure you guys heard the story of how I don't even think he played when they went to scout him. I think they saw him in warmups and ended up drafting him. So his story, the whole story behind Pex is unbelievable. It's you know, it was an honor to have him as a goalie for as long as we did, and you know, after my time there, you guys had him for another 4 or 5 years. So phenomenal teammate, great person, did great things in the community, and there's no one more deserving of it than him. And you know, it's going to be an exciting night, and you know, it'll be an honor to be a part of it.
Well, David, it's certainly good to talk to you again. I was just starting my career, you know, your last couple of years here in Nashville. So you were always great to deal with, though. So I appreciate it. And best of luck with everything moving forward, and hope to see you in Smashville again soon.
Okay, I'll talk to you guys soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, David Leguan, former Predator, the first ever draft pick by the Nashville Predators, joining us here on the show. When we come back, we'll talk to Olympic gold medalist Scott Hamilton. That's all next on Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Chase McCabe here with you. Appreciate David Leguan for joining us in the first segment. Now we're joined by Scott Hamilton, Olympic gold medalist and an awesome friend, just an all-around good guy. I got to talk to him the other night on the pregame show and get to spend a little more time with him now. And you just heard the promo for the show that we're doing for Floyd Reese, and it's interesting how you can tie everything together. We lost Floyd to cancer this year, and you know, I had told you about my dad, and obviously all you do to raise money for cancer research, it literally hits everybody. Like, everyone can have a story of being connected to cancer and how it affects people.
It's so true. And when you know, even just looking at and it's hard, you know, because we talked the other night, and you know, I lost my mom 45 years ago almost, and there's not a day I don't talk about her. There's not a day I don't think about her. And when you think that 69 people an hour are succumbing to this disease, we have to do something. You know, we just can't sit back and think that it'll take care of itself, or there's really good people out there and they're going to do the right thing. No, we all have to work together and solve this problem. And it's huge. And when I say 69 people, I don't just mean like 69, like, I mean, it's a brother, a mother, a sister, a father. It's someone that's loved and needed in the family. And it's a horrible thing. And so I, you know, when I lost my mom, I became a fundraiser. And when I survived cancer, I looked at it as a second chance in life. And I really look at it as now I'm an activist, and I want to do whatever I can with whatever I can to change the way people are treated for cancer forever. And, you know, when we put that stake, you know, kind of in the ground and said, no, we're only going to fund immunotherapy research from this day forward, that's what we're doing. And, you know, we really want to just treat the cancer and spare the patient harm in the process. And so that's what we've been doing. And we do it through events. We do it through peer-to-peer fundraising. We do it through however we can do it. And we're really trying to make a difference for the next person facing this disease. It's horrible.
I want you to expand on that a little bit, because I've always found that fascinating with you of, you know, you go through your personal journey with cancer, and, you know, it's very easy to go, all right, I beat it. I get a second chance. And, you know, you could do other things just for your life and just for you, but you have spent your life working for others and knowing what you went through and trying to help other people not have to go through that or to make their journey a little easier. Why do you feel like you were called to do that?
You know, that's a really tough question to answer. I think, you know, I've been given so much in my life. You know, I was an unwanted, unintended child. I was given a family. I was very sick as a child. I was given really solid health care. You know, I was, I showed an interest in skating. I was given good coaching and an opportunity to you know, so I've always been given. And I think in this particular, you know, I love my mom, you know, more than anyone, and losing her was beyond devastating, you know? So in that, I feel like I have to honor that, you know, mm-hmm. I have to honor her sacrifices and her love for me and everything she did to make sure that I had everything I needed. And then when I survived, it was just sort of one of those things where it was 20 years after I lost her, and all those years, you know, I'd raise money where I could. And now I knew what it felt like to go through cancer. I knew the fear of the diagnosis. I knew the fear of the biopsy process, you know, the news when it comes that you have, you know, whatever that, you know, cancer is. And it's just, it's extraordinary to know that I'm here 25 years later because of two research scientists in Indiana that came up with a combo of chemo drugs that happened to work on my particular form of cancer. And, you know, even that, you know, knowing that I survived due to this chemo, I know that there's a better way. And chemotherapy, you know, many people aren't strong enough to endure it. And so we need to make changes in that. And just unleashing, we've learned so much over the last 2 years about our own immune system through COVID. And I think people are really beginning to understand that our bodies are miraculous instruments. Yes, our bodies, you know, for whatever reason, created the cancer. Well, why can't we teach our bodies how to recognize and destroy the cancer? I mean, our bodies right now are finding dead or broken cells and just totally getting rid of them. Why can't we teach our bodies or allow our bodies to understand that that particular cell is destructive and doesn't belong there and needs to go? And so 2 years after we decided to only go into immunotherapy, targeted therapies, the first immunotherapy drug hit the market with CAR-T for lymphoma. And it's miraculous how it works, you know, and now I'm on a Moffitt Cancer Center call and they're talking about stage 4 lung cancer treated with immunotherapy and people are in full remission. Those things couldn't happen, you know, like not even 5 years ago. So you're looking at, you know, what it means to invest in the future. And that's where I am. All I want to do is invest in the future. And we're taking on really tough cancers. Like with Sunday, our big show at Bridgestone Arena, yeah. we're going after glioblastoma brain cancer. And when you think of, you know, historical figures, you know, John McCain and Ted Kennedy, and Bo Biden, Tug McGraw, you know, so many people have died that we know of this brain cancer that offers little hope for survival. So, you know, we know that it's knocked on our door this year twice. Once with Scott Williams, who decided as someone living with this disease that he was going to ride the entire length of the Natchez Trace, 444 miles on a bicycle to raise money for cancer. I've never been so inspired in my life as to watch this man whose days are, you know, possibly numbered. We don't know God's plan for Scott, but you know, the prognosis when you have Cleo, you know, he had days and he decided to spend them making a difference. Those things inspire me. And so when we remembered Michael Busby, you know, Busby Music, and we just felt like this was a great opportunity to celebrate his life, his music with the artists that he created that music with, to invest all the money raised for an answer to his form of cancer. And so that's what we do. You know, we're given an opportunity and, you know, we try to do whatever we can to make a difference for the next person diagnosed with this horrible disease.
Yeah. And you mentioned coming up on Sunday, the event that you have at Bridgestone Arena, the Scott Hamilton and Friends, starting at 5:00 at Bridgestone. And then you'll have another event over at Omni Hotel afterwards. But I know you put so much time and so much love into this, but it's always a fun event. And like you said, what we're talking about for a good cause.
Well, you count your wins, you know, and that's the one thing, you know, we've done with CARES, you know, my platform that we raise money. I've never taken a penny, not in 45 years for raising money for cancer. I won't do it. And especially with CARES, you know, we want to raise, and we're a small organization that collaborates with large organizations to truly make a difference. And you know, it is that it's that idea that there's an opportunity to make a difference here. There's an opportunity to change cancer forever. And I've seen it, you know, again, I'm living proof that research works. And, you know, when we think of, you know, creating chemocare.com to really educate newly diagnosed patients, what chemotherapy is and how to go through it, and what are the side effects and how to manage them in eighth grade English and Spanish. You know, I was the organ grinder's monkey for 5 years to make that website a reality. And now it's serving millions and millions and millions of patients. And that's a win. And when I didn't know how to go through cancer, you know, I had a doctor, I had nurses, I had friends and family. That's three angels. What was missing was the fourth angel. And that was someone who's been there, done that, that can work as a mentor, a life coach. And, you know, so we created it. We have the fourth angel mentoring program where we pair newly diagnosed patients with survivors, and they, you know, they serve as role models and guides and life coaches. They're not medical information. It's about what it felt like to go through it and how I did it. And I'm still here, and you are going to be that way too. So it's a really beautiful relationship. We've extended that to caregivers and to pediatric caregivers, and all that lives in Cleveland where CARES was founded, but now we're in an independent foundation. And we understand that, you know, this is something that we can make a difference in, but we can only do that with the numbers and the, you know, people that we recruit to be a part of our army. So that's why we do events. That's why we want to share the experience. We want everybody to play a role in this. And once we do, you know, everyone can take ownership in the fact that we did this. We solved this problem. We saved lives. That's what we do. And it's, you know, I invite everyone to join me in this battle, and all they have to do is show up. And if they want to do more, they can. But just being in the building to show in numbers, not only the celebration of a life of Michael Busby, but also celebrating the promise of a better future that we together made happen.
How big have the Predators been in their support and getting behind you on all this and helping out?
Oh, they're amazing. You know, when I pitched this, it was about, I guess, the second year that we were doing the Skating Academy, and I was talking to Sean Henry and Jeff Gogan about it. And they were like, 100% all in. Yeah, you got it. Anything you need, you got it. Anything, we're going to support you 100% in all this. We're going to make it happen. It was just, are you sure? And they were like, yes. So, you know, the year one, we postponed because the forces of nature, we weren't ready yet. And then, you know, for the last, you know, I guess this will be the fifth of the last 6 years, we've been able to put on a big event at Bridgestone Arena with the most incredible musicians ever. You know, Sheryl Crow was there for me the first 4 years. And when you think of, you know, we had Florida Georgia Line and Chris Young and Kenny Loggins and, you know, the members of Journey and Dino Elefante, John Elefante of Kansas. And, you know, we just one after another, the artists that have come through, Jewel, Darius Rucker. I mean, all the artists that have come through to support us, it's just been astounding that we've been able to put on these shows. And these are people that have been touched directly by cancer, as we all have, that really want to make a difference. And we want to keep this event going and growing. And hopefully we'll put ourselves out of business one day. But the Predators have been extraordinary. And I want to thank, you know, the leadership of the Predators, Sean Henry, you know, everyone that's just said yes to allowing us to do this in Bridgestone and supporting us every step of the way.
He is Scott Hamilton, an amazing person, an Olympic gold medalist. We'll have more with him as when we come back here on Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Yes, it is back here on Smashville Live here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Chase McCabe and Scott Hamilton, Olympic gold medalist, my guest right now. And Scott, I want to talk about that a little bit because it's coming up. It's kind of weird that we had the Summer Olympics and now this winter we're going to have the Winter Olympics. But because of COVID, everything got pushed around. But really, really excited about that. And you obviously won 1984 in figure skating. Can you remember what the hardest thing you attempted was during those Olympics?
Yeah, it was a triple Lutz. You know, that was kind of, it wasn't the top. Triple axel was being done by, I think, three guys did it in the competition, Brian Orser, Brian Boitano, and Alexander Fadeev. And, you know, so triple Lutz was kind of my money jump. It's the next, you know, most difficult one to triple axel. And then, you know, after that, you know, the next Olympics was triple axel again. And then, the quad started sneaking their way in. And when you look at Nathan Chen, who will be performing at Bridgestone Arena in January for the U.S. Figure Skating Championships, he'll do five, maybe six quads in his program, which, you know, when I was skating, quads were for freaks and mutants. You know, it wasn't for like normal people that kind of put their pants on one leg at a time. So, you know, looking at what they're doing now and what they had to do was just reinvent how they get into the jump. You know, the takeoff is the same, but it's how they start the rotation. It's a complete revolution in technique, which couldn't have happened when I was skating because you were up and you went up and then in. And now it's up and in at the same time. And it just makes everything much more efficient. I don't know why we didn't do it like that back then, but it's changed so much, you know, not only the way it's performed, but the way it's scored. And it's really exciting to see that, you know, the competition isn't over to the last skater and the Nashvillians will get to see that up close and personal in January when we host the U.S. Figure Skating Championships that will choose the Olympic team on the way to Beijing. It'll happen right here in Nashville. And I couldn't be more excited.
So when people go to that and they see everybody perform their programs, they're seeing the finished product. They're seeing, this is what we put together to win the U.S. championships and then go on to the Olympics. But how much goes into it behind the scenes? I mean, how many times do you fall trying to practice all this stuff?
Well, I did the math. You know, Nathan Chen, you know, he has me doubled and he has, you know, he's only 20, like 3 years old or something ridiculous, 22. You know, I figured that I fell probably around 41,600 times, you know, when I skated. And, you know, the cool thing about that is when you get up 41,600 times, failure doesn't take on the same identity, you know, you just keep going. Right. And so Nathan said he's fallen over 100,000 times and it's like, wow, man. And he's so young. Like I had, it took me a long time to accumulate all those falls. But it's just, you know, you go out and you try something and you got to learn how to do it. And pain is a really incredible teacher and you fall down and you get up, you fall down and you get up. And pretty soon, you know, you're landing it perfectly. Pretty soon, you know, you're able to kind of add to that and do things in combination. It's like a forward progression in skill. And, you know, but it's all rooted in failure, you know, and, you know, you on the night, you're not allowed to fail at all. You've got to be clean as a whistle.
Well, and when you're teaching kids how to, you know, to skate and how to do all this, I mean, obviously they're going to fall and it's scary. I mean, that's the, you know, I'm a taller guy. I've been on ice skates a few times in my life and I'm holding onto the wall because I'm scared to fall.
Yeah, it's me but now.
You have to fall. I mean, that's a part of it.
Part of it. Like when we teach, you know, people how to skate, whether it doesn't matter if they're 2 years old or 92 years old, you know, the first thing we teach them is how to fall and how to get up because it's going to happen and more now than maybe later on. But yeah, you learn how to fall and, you know, this is the best way to, you know, don't let, you know, go over backwards off your heels because that's just bad, really bad. You want to forward and you want to, you know, learn how to fall. So if you start to lose your balance, just, you know, surrender to it this way. And then here's how you get up. And it's amazing. That's what we teach every learn to skate class at Fort Ice Centers at Bellevue and in Antioch is first class, all the skaters, this is how you fall and this is how you get up. And then once they know that, it just, you know, they're able to kind of like, okay, let's get up and try it again. Let's get up and try it again. Let's get up and try it again.
Well, Scott, this has been a lot of fun tonight. Real quick, Sunday coming up 5 o'clock at Bridgestone Arena, Scott Hamilton and friends, your annual event. And it's good to have it back after COVID. Is you'll benefit the Scott Hamilton Cares Foundation. You do such great work. And I know you're celebrating this year in memory of Busby, and to fundraise for all of the cancer research. And you mentioned the immunotherapy as well as a part of it, but really looking forward to the event on Sunday.
Well, we are too. And we're swinging for the fences. We're trying to get as many people in the building as we can. Lots of great seats still available at Bridgestone Arena. Unfortunately, the Omni event is sold out, and you know, we're going to be wedged in there pretty tight, but our goals are specific. We have to raise this year $1.25 million. And that's just, that all has to go to research. And so, you know, we're solving a big problem, and the research that we're doing is important. And I'm just hoping that people will get behind us so that we can look back and know that glioblastoma was a cancer that offered little hope or none. Yeah. And we can create that hope just through everybody working together to come and support this event so we can support the research scientists that are going to make the next miracle happen. And I appreciate you allowing me to get the shout out again. And yeah, it's great talking to you, and you know, hope to see you there. You know, come out and help us light the place up and really give a lot of people hope.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's such a great event. Scott, thanks as always. We will do it again soon. That's going to do it for this edition of Smashville Live. My thanks to David Leguan and Scott Hamilton for joining us here tonight. But stick around. Penalty Box Radio, that's next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.